Welcome to the One Within All to the Interverse. I'm your host, Chance, and it's a great honor to be once again prying open your third ear and ushering you towards the imagination portal to an expanded perception of this magical reality. Amongst the modern trend towards soul-suffocating scientific materialism, there remain sparks and embers of a time when our ancestral mind had not yet been forcibly amputated by the misguided hegemony of homogenized agents of empire. The emptiness of spirit, enforced by inquisitions and witch hunters, has carved out a vacuum within our being, in which the longing for fullness within acts as a cavitation pressure gradient, propelling a pendulum swing, quickening manifest as a genuine grasping at gnosis, a feeling surely shared by all of us who are attracted to podcasts like this one. Perhaps nowhere on earth is this alchemical process more profoundly pronounced than in Germany and its surrounding regions. Home to a people long targeted by papal suppressions and propaganda purveyors, going back to the early Roman expansions and possibly beyond, so much so that Germanophobia remains a pillar of Hollywood storytelling with no so-called social justice warriors to be found at their defense. Our guest today has led a life immersed in these philosophically fertile fields, where the germ of man's divinity has been covered by darkness time after time, only to break through into the light as the countless sprouts of wisdom and beauty that could only emerge in a place like Germany. His name is Dr. Christopher McIntosh, and although born and raised in Scotland, Dr. McIntosh has lived a great deal of his life amongst the descendants of those rebellious Germanic tribes, researching a huge variety of esoteric traditions and nature-oriented belief systems. As the author of more books than I could easily count, McIntosh is a living repository of witness to the unquenchable enlightenment process that defines the human condition. And today we'll be discussing his book, Occult Germany, Old Gods, Mystics, and Magicians, a whirlwind tour through the ancient roots of this widely misunderstood nation that takes the reader along for the ride past the so-called barbarian tribes of Roman times, underground alchemists of the Middle Ages, visionary artists and psychological innovators, inventors, neo-pagans, and much more, telling the story of Germany's esoteric underpinnings in a way that only he can. Find his book linked in the show notes along with his website, ozgard.net, that's ozgard.net, and support the man's lifetime of investigation while edifying your own occult education. I'm supremely excited to dive into this one, so let's get this podcast started with the Odic Force Educator and Mystic Magic Investigator, Dr. Christopher McIntosh. Welcome to Interverse, man. It's a great pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you. A pleasure to be on the show.
Absolutely. Yes, this is going to be a good one. And I wanted to just start by covering the groundwork of how you find yourself, in Germany and why that area seems to have attracted you for such a large part of your life. You know, the mystic underpinnings of the nation, the geography. What really speaks to you about being there?
Well, I've had a long involvement with Germany since my early childhood. I grew up in the 1950s in Edinburgh, in Scotland, And we had a young German woman staying with us as an au pair. And she was called Ingrid. And I adored Ingrid. She was like a kind of fairy godmother to me. And so, of course, I came to love her country. And she taught me my first words of German. And I kept in contact with her over the years periodically. And at the age of 13, I started learning German in school. And then when I began to write about esoteric things, I discovered how important Germany was in terms of the esoteric traditions. And one of the things that I discovered was the Rosicrucian tradition and how important it was. And so I wrote a book on the history of the Rosicrucian movement. And then later on, I went on to write a PhD dissertation on the Rosicrucians. And one way or another, I kept on going back to Germany. Meanwhile, I had lost contact with Ingrid for a period of about 20 years. And then one day I was on a train traveling from Vienna back to England, and there was a rail strike and the train stopped at Bonn. So I remembered that Ingrid lived near Bonn, and I gave her a call and said, could I stay with her? And so she came and picked me up at the station, and I went and stayed with her. And so I reestablished the contact, and I remained in contact with her, especially after I moved to Germany about 30 years ago, and remained in contact with her until her death a couple of years ago. So that was an important factor in my developing my interest in Germany and my love for Germany. So that's basically the story of my involvement with Germany. As I say, I've been here for 30 years now. I'm married to a German woman and have German citizenship. So I'm very much rooted here.
It's almost a synchronicity worthy of Young himself to have that train, hold up and then wind up on leading you on the path to what's basically your life's work and deep passion. That's amazing.
Yes.
So one of the things in your book that really made me know for sure that this was something I wanted to talk about on the show is your acknowledgement that, referring to what we can know about history, I'm going to quote you. You say, there's a kind of archaeology that is not about digging for bones and pottery shards, but rather probing into myths, legends, customs, symbols, and words. These things too have their layers, their buried messages, their footprints of the ancestors. That's an extremely profound statement. That's how I tend to operate as well in my fascination with our human potential. Looking into the deep past is a good way to get an idea what we might be able to accomplish in the future. And philology, etymology, the rites and rituals of one people or another, these are things that can syncretize and help us, get over the perceived differences and realize that there's a shared deep human experience that the mystical, the mystical worldview opens us up to. So maybe we could start on that in the deepest history of Germany and its peoples that, we can be aware of.
Well, the interface between history and myth is something that's always fascinated me. The way in which history is constantly being mythologized and the way that history, myth in turn influences history. And one of the ways in which this happens is on the level of national heroes who very quickly turn into figures of mythology. I mean, we saw that in Britain, for example, with the virtual deification of Princess Diana after her death. So she's now become a sort of a mythical figure. And one can find examples of this in Germany as well. There's a legend connected with the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, the medieval emperor, who is said to be asleep in a cave in the Kufhäuser mountain range in Thuringia. And he said, it is said that he wakes up every 100 years and asks a dwarf if the ravens are still circling round the mountain. And if they are, he just goes back to sleep again. But one day he's going to wake up and come back and lead Germany to great things. Well, this legend was invoked when Germany was united under Bismarck and a new emperor was chosen, Wilhelm I. And on this occasion, a huge monument was erected in the Kyffhäuser Mountains, and with an equestrian statue of the Emperor Wilhelm, and at the base of the mountain, a statue of Barbarossa with a raven behind him. So this was a way of linking the figure of the new emperor with this legend of Barbarossa. And of course, at the time of the invasion of Russia during the Second World War, the invasion was given the codename Operation Barbarossa. So that's one example of this interface that I was talking about.
I like that example. And you know, I caught you a few times playing with letter swaps in the book, the way that can be done in philological investigations, like the D swapping with the T. There's also a lot of common occurrence of R's and L's swapping. So whether it's just a like synchromistic thread to pull on, or it's indicative of a deeper mythology that our history is actually concealed by or meshed with, just Barbarossa as a name makes me think of the ancient Celtic and also Mesopotamian god Bel, you know, Bar and Bel or Baal. And yes. the second part of his name, you know, vowels are very interchangeable between dialects and accents. So I looked at Barbarossa and I just thought, Baal Isi, and Isi could be savior or Isis. And the story with the ravens is interesting. You have Odin's ravens.
Although literally the name means red beard.
I also like the statue that is, I've never been to Germany, so there's a particular statue of Hermann, I believe it was called, or Arminius.
Yeah, Arminius, yes, who defeated the Roman legions in the year 9 AD. And there's a huge monument to him, the Arminius Monument.
And in this monument, he's got a winged cap. And you look at his name, and his name is essentially a version of Hermes, who wears a winged cap.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but it's true.
Yeah, it's just right there hiding out in the name. And this is, you know, this is an example of how powerful literacy with symbolism can be for somebody to invoke the sense of the sacred into your worldview. And maybe a good place to start in talking about, you know, modern Germany as well is what you think the consequences are of mythical illiteracy and the cycle of mythical repression and resurgence that has gone on in that area.
Well, I think this has meant that Germany has a troubled relationship with its cultural psyche and cultural identity, and this has partly to do with its history, because Germany is in one sense a very old nation. In its previous incarnation as the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, it goes back more than 1,000 years. But as a modern nation state, it's really only existed since the foundation of Bismarck's Reich in 1871. And it was just getting into its prime as a great power when it was struck down by the First World War, and then soon after that, again by the Second World War. So it came to be thought of or seen as, the Germans came to be seen as, in a way, the naughty children of Europe. And to some extent, this is their self-image today. So this has had, as I say, a damaging effect on the cultural identity of the country. For example, if you look at the collective mythology, when I was growing up in Britain, I was very much aware of the cultural history and the collective mythology. So I was very much conscious of historical figures and figures from the figures of legend, like King Arthur and the whole complex of stories around the Knights of the Round Table and the Holy Grail and all of that, and historical figures like King Arthur, who fought the Danish invaders, and then again semi mythological figures like Robin Hood, and so on, and so all of this was very much part of my education when I was growing up. Well, in Germany, there's a lot of people are completely ignorant about their own history and inherited mythology. For example, when I was teaching English at the University of Bremen, in one class, we got onto the subject of the Holy Grail. Well, now, to me, that's one of those universal references. You know, I from a very early age, I was hearing stories about the Knights of the Round Table and the quest for the Holy Grail and Sir Galahad and Percival and all of that. But I asked the students in this class if they knew what the Holy Grail was. And only one young man raised his hand and said, "Oh well, yes, I think it has something to do with rejuvenation and the quest for eternal life." But apart from that, he hadn't a clue. So I found that rather sad, because it's something that should also be well known to the German public, because one of the great medieval epics is Parsifal by Wolfram von Eschenbach. And then you've got the treatment of the Grail in Wagner's operas, in the opera called Parsifal, and one called Lohengrin. So it is part of the German cultural heritage, but these students didn't have a clue. I think that's a pity. And one of the things that I hope my book will do is to make the Germans more aware of their own esoteric and mystical history. And hopefully at some point it will be translated into German.
I really enjoyed the alchemical aspects of the book, and whenever you brought up Parzival, I'd heard of this. I was a Brit Lit guy in college and things like that, English major, so even got to take an entire course on Arthurian legend, so a lot of this stuff was somewhere in my memory banks. But there was a particular passage you quote from Eschenbach where you basically, to quote it, that the Grail is not a Christian relic, but a kind of stone possessing miraculous powers. And he says in the text, Legantinus, the heathen, saw with his own eyes in the constellations things he was shy to talk about, hidden mysteries. He said there was a thing called the Grail, whose name he had read clearly in the constellations. Also that a host of angels left it on earth and flew away up over the stars. That really jumped out to me. One thing I've covered extensively on the show is the interplay between astrotheology or astrology and myth and religion. And so with the Grail in particular, I'd never really thought about where might that be up in the stars. My first thought is potentially the constellation Ophiuchus, because it has this, it's this transformation aspect of the zodiac, the constellation stepping up and off the zodiac, an ascension type metaphor. And the core of that constellation or asterism is also seen as a stone or a tombstone, like the rectangular block in the center. So that may be what's being referred to. I've often noticed that whenever things are like, you know, mysteries are looked at through the astrotheology lens and then the alchemical lens, there is sometimes confusion or inconsistency as these two systems use the same language and symbols, but don't necessarily put things in the same order or have the same meaning behind it. And with that, I'm wondering, you know, have you done a lot of study of the star scripture, the scripture in the stars in astrotheology, or how that might have been preserved? And I know there's some artifacts that indicate that the ancient Germans had quite an extensive astronomical interest. But yeah, where has that type of research landed for you?
Well, there's one interesting theory about the Grail. The word krater in Greek, which means a vessel, which is cognate with the word crater. And there is actually the area that is now the Czech Republic was where a couple of million years ago an asteroid fell and caused a huge crater. And there's always been a special mystique attached to this particular territory. And there's a collective memory of this event. And so there is one theory that the Grail is literally this crater that was caused by this asteroid falling. But there are many that might account for the, or it might help to account for the particular mystique attached to the territory of Bohemia, as it used to be called. What else can I say about the Grail?
Well, we could also talk about the, well, something that just popped in my head. I don't know a lot of German, but I do have some familiarity with ancient Greek and Latin. And when we're talking about Grail and the Greek equivalent crater as a word, it's very similar to another ancient Greek word, Kratos or Kratos, which means strength or power. And so there's power in the Grail. There could be some wordplay in that. That's one of the things about astrotheology and mysticism in general, the notion that wordplay and punning represent divine revelation for the seeker. And I love to play with that possibility. But there is the Nebra sky disk. What can we say about that artifact? I really like the old artifacts that you talk about early in the book.
Yes, the Nebra sky disk is quite remarkable. It was found not long ago, and it's a kind of moon lunar calendar, basically, which is very interesting that they were using a lunar calendar probably for agricultural purposes. And there have been a number of other artifacts discovered, some of them very much older. I mean, for example, there's the Venus of Willendorf, which is a statuette of a large-breasted woman, which is some 30,000 years old, and found in Austria in the early 20th century. And this has sometimes been taken as evidence that there was at that time a matriarchal culture in Europe. There's an archaeologist, Maria Gimbutas, who wrote a number of books about this theory. And there have been a number of other objects dating from the Stone Age that have been discovered. For example, a flute made from the bone of a vulture, which is even older. It's about 35,000 years old. So, and that tells you quite a lot about the Stone Age people of that region, that they had the impulse to make music, and they had the skill to make a flute out of the bone of a vulture. So this sort of belies the idea that the people of Northern Europe, the prehistoric people of Northern Europe, were just primitive people without any culture to speak of.
Indeed, they had quite a powerful culture. Another artifact that I hadn't heard of before that you talked about are these conical golden caps.
And
those are really something. I recommend people look that up. Just, I think you can find it if you just search like ancient German conical headpiece. And these things look amazing. Actually, I've had lots of like biodynamic and subtle energy specialists on the show before, and probably anybody with much of a toe dipped into anything New Age is aware of pyramid power, right? You know, meditating under pyramids and things of that nature. But some of my more trusted and respected sources have informed me that actually the cone shape has a better, like a magnetic property or stronger many times over than the pyramid. And here we have these golden hats that are big cones, and gold being very conductive. What are your thoughts on those particular relics? They're quite amazing.
Well, I think the cone shape is perhaps similar to the bishop's mitre, which may be designed for the same purpose or a similar purpose.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that there's a thread through all of ancient Europe that, let's talk about the magical practice of Seder. I'll let you introduce that, and then, you know, we'll see what we might be able to connect it to, the Seder magic.
Yeah, well, Seder is the ancient magical technique of the Nordic peoples. And it was actually reserved for women. It was usually reserved for women, although occasionally men did practice it, but the men who practiced it were rather looked down upon. So it was essentially a woman's art. And women in the Nordic tradition were very much respected. And if you read the Nordic sagas, they're full of very strong, forceful, self-confident women who often play an important role, a leading role. Well, they're often portrayed as much stronger and more forceful than the menfolk. So this is one of the, I think one of the things that attracts me to the Nordic tradition.
I think one of the most fascinating threads that permeates the book Occult Germany is this notion of the union of opposites in almost an alchemical sense, and how the church and Roman Empire represent just one side of a polarity or dynamism, and is not balanced in that way. And, you know, I'd like you to talk about that concept, and then, you know, I'll add bits to have you flesh out that I think are good representatives of the notion.
Well, one has to be aware of the particular nature of German spirituality, which has a strong tradition of combining the spiritual and the material. This goes right back to people like Hildegard of Bingen, who was a medieval abbess, and she was also a physician and a herbalist and a composer and much else. So she was someone who very much combined spirituality with the material. She's a very, very spiritual, religious person, but also very practical, very effective physician. And she was a visionary. Many of the remedies that she used had been imparted to her in visions. Then there was Paracelsus, the great 16th century alchemist and physician. Again, he was also a theologian, wrote as much about religion as he did about medicine and alchemy. And you had mystical writers like Jakob Boehme, who were constantly using alchemical language, alchemical metaphors in their writings. And there's a strong mystique of metallurgy. It goes together with the mystique of alchemy. So you had the poet Novalis, who was actually a mining engineer. So he was very, very mystical. He wrote lots of mystical poetry, but again he had this this very practical side. So this is something very German, this combination of the spiritual and the material. And I think this accounts for why the alchemical tradition was so strong in Germany. And you get the same thing. It goes right up to recent times. with, for example, a figure like Rudolf Steiner, who saw himself very much as being in the Rosicrucian tradition. And he was very insistent that spirituality shouldn't just sort of float in some ethereal realm, but should be brought down into the physical world through the hands. So he developed a kind of homeopathic medicines based on the Paracelsian tradition, basically, and all kinds of other very practical things, like his biodynamic agriculture, his Waldorf schools, and the dance method called eurythmia, and so on. So he's another example of this combination. So as I say, that's something very German, and it's thanks to German figures that the alchemical tradition is still alive today. When you think of someone like Frater Albertus, who came from Germany and went to America and started the Paracelsus Research Society. So I think this is one great contribution that Germany has made.
I really couldn't agree more. And whether there are spiritual forces underpinning all of these grand movements of history and civilization, or some guiding hand behind the scenes in human guise that is responsible for it, I find it fascinating how just the even name to call a people the germ mans. A germ is in terms of the origin of that concept, it's a seed containing the generative power, right? So it's a life symbol. But in around the same time period as Germanophobia, I would say was on the rise, but more like in a resurgence, because this has been a cyclical thing going back to Roman times and maybe before, that around the same time between the late 1800s up to about World War I was when germ theory began finding popularity in European and American medicine practices, which... Oh, yeah. Regardless of people's opinion on it, we can just say flatly that that's actually still a theory. It's actually still a theory, whether or not take your beliefs aside, anybody out there, that's fine. But the consequence of germ theory is very like the consequence of the Holy Roman Empire's inquisitions and such. It's a sterilizing force. It's an anti-life force. It's a neutering force. Hand sanitizer on everything. and that is fascinating, because at the same time that germ became a dirty word, the Germans were moving towards becoming the vilified figures of the world for a few rounds of world wars. I find that really interesting. I wondered, what that makes you think of.
Well, that's a big subject. I hadn't thought of this connection between the word German and the word germ, but it's an interesting thought, as you say. Maybe these things operate at a sort of unconscious level collectively. Could be. But as I say, this way in which this negative image that you talk about has been transferred to the Germans themselves is very damaging. For example, I'm very fond of German folk songs and folk dances. But many people look look down upon those things. They would say, "Oh, that's all. It's not what they would call in German Zeitgemäß, meaning sort of up to date. It's all kind of anachronistic. You know, things that we'd rather forget about. You know, we'd rather listen to modern pop music than folk songs." You know, this cultural inheritance, if it's allowed to disappear, then it's very difficult to revive it.
I think that Germany has noticed that exact sentiment, that once it disappears, it's very hard to revive it. With the scanty information available about their ancestors' beliefs and practices prior to Tacitus's writings on the Germanic peoples, right? And the attempts to revive ancient forms of paganism that have been very challenging for anyone aspiring to do so on a large cultural movement scale.
Yeah, that's right.
But back to this union of opposites, I think Jung is a crucial figure to this idea being popularized in a psychological way. And I didn't know that Hermann Hesse also wrote about Abraxas, which I think is fascinating, because back to this sterilized, only the light, you know, only the masculine, only the father form of religion that the Roman Catholic Church imposed upon Europe, the idea of Abraxas, as Hesse says, he says, "We had indeed a God whom we honored, but he represented only one half of the world, that is to say, the official authorized world of light. But we ought to be able to honor the whole world. And so we must have either one God, who is also devil, or side by side with the cult of God, we should institute a cult of the devil. So we had Abraxas, the God who was both God and devil." So there's that. And then Jung has the seven servants to the dead, which I'll leave it to you to describe that. But it's one of my favorite, brief texts of all time. But these polarities in their separation become so neutral. But when brought together, there's so much power.
Yes. Well, Hermann Hesse writes about Abraxas in a beautiful novel that he wrote called Damian. Do you know that novel?
I have not read that. I've actually only read Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one as well. But yes, in Damian, he talks about Abraxas, and he actually got it from Jung. But as you say, this union of opposites is important. You get that in the Nordic mythology, where you have, for example, the figure of Loki, who is the trickster god who's always causing mischief, and sometimes very serious mischief. Sometimes he gets up to really unpleasant things, but he is, in a way, he's part of he's part of the universe, and he is, you could say, he's sort of the grain of sand in the oyster, Loki, he's representative of a kind of trickster figure who appears in many mythologies. But as you say, in the Christian scheme of things, element is left out and suppressed.
Loki, I suspect, is related to the, you know, in ancient Britain, the Druids and their notion of the Logue, which is similar to the idea of the logos or the light. It's philologically mm-hmm. cognate with other words for light, like lux, as is Loki. I think Christianity is, as the Reverend Robert Taylor said and was jailed for in the 1800s, he says Christianity and paganism are as different from each other as six and half a dozen. And the Christianity took the old world's system and made it into a system of sterilization and control and suppression by I think knowingly on some level separating these poles and making their savior figure and a devil figure that are at odds and irreconcilable, right? I see Loki is very much an early logos savior motif and is one of my favorite of all mythological characters. Actually, we've done a lot about Loki around here. And there's not a question in there, but I will move us back over to Jung, because in the notion of the generative power and the germ of life that comes from this union of opposites, I think his description of Abraxas is one of the most profound ways to consider what is God or the spirit that, the more ancient idea of the deity. It's the unseen mover, the thing that causes everything to move, but is not necessarily physically present. And he describes in the Seven Sermons of the Dead, Abraxas as basically effectiveness itself or power itself, that in the pleroma of all things with combined with their opposites, the soup of everythingness that is indistinguishable from nothingness by it all being mushed together. The one thing that stands out is that effectiveness cannot be canceled out by ineffectiveness, or power cannot be canceled out by non-power. Existence cannot be nullified by non-existence, because non-existence is non-existent. And to me, like that, when I came across that, it's been spinning that wheel in my mind for years since that notion came into my awareness. And I think it's the perfect way to conceive of God that puts it beyond the idea of good or evil or God and devil, that effectiveness is the generative power itself, that we're talking about the union of opposites being at its essence.
Yeah. Yes.
So.
Yes, I would go along with that.
And nothing to add. That's okay. I have plenty of other threads to go to, but I feel like that might be the deepest wisdom one can really attain, is to get beyond good and evil in that way, just to the pure essence of effectiveness. Well, let's go back to, I really liked the Hildegard of Bingen that you brought
Bingen.
In, you quoted Liber Simplicis Medicinae. In all creation, trees, plants, animals, and gemstones, there are hidden secret powers which no person can know of unless they are revealed by God. To which you say, the notion of the sacred in material creation is found repeatedly in German thought. Then, I think that's the ultimate jive of the priesthood, was to convince people that there's a spirit world out there and a material world here, when all evidence of our senses and experience would inform us that there is no separation between spirit and matter. Could we talk a little bit more about Hildegard and even how more modern doctors have tried to apply some of her ideas?
Oh, yes. And are still doing so. She was a very interesting figure. She was in some ways quite unorthodox. There were times when she got into trouble with the church for what she was saying and doing, but she always managed to get out of trouble, because she was a very clever theologian, and she was always able to defend herself very cleverly. But she was quite remarkably many faceted. She, as I said, she was a composer. She was an artist. She She painted wonderful pictures of her visions. And some of them show orbs, you know, like those orbs that appear in people's photographs from time to time. So she was in this tradition that we've been talking about, this combination of the spiritual and the material. And there were other German mystics who were also quite heterodox, like Meister Eckhart, the medieval mystical writer. He was actually a Dominican, a member of the Dominican order, but he also got into trouble with the church, and at one point was accused of heresy. But I think before it actually came to the trial, he died of natural causes. But he was also in that same tradition, and he said, in fact, that one of the things he said was that the soul is identical with God, which in a way is similar to the Indian Vedantic notion that the Godhead, the supreme deity, is actually present in each human soul. So there's always been this tension, I think, in German history between these rather heterodox figures and the official Christian doctrine.
I've particularly enjoyed learning about Meister Eckhart's philosophy and that blending of the Christian and the Brahmanist ideals. There are some, you know, my favorite era of mythological inquiry has got to be the period between around 1800 to 1840. There was just, especially the British researchers from around then, they had access to things that are further away from us now and more clouded and cluttered by all the noise culturally that has developed since then. I mean, you go to do an internet search on the name of a mythological figure, and before you find anything relevant to real life or history, you got to wade through about 30 TV shows and video games that use that name as a character. So there's a lot of noise, but I don't know if you've come across the notion that was floating around back then that the Saxon people were actually a form of Buddhists, that Saka is a name of Buddha. In Japan, they still call Buddha Saka, and the Sase, or the Saxons, and the Near East Asian Buddhists, some kind of crossover between their cultures, or a even further back, more ancient philosophy or priesthood system developed into the diverging systems that Europe and Asia took on later. Have you seen any evidence to support that? I know Hermann Hesse, as a German, and writing about Siddhartha Buddha might be an interesting clue to that. But is there anything that rings a bell about what I'm saying with the Saxons and Buddha or Saka?
Well, it's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that. But, I mean, the Germans are obviously part of the European, Indo-European family tree, so to speak. Which originated somewhere in probably what is now Central Russia, and then spread out in east and west. So there are linguistically also all kinds of connections between the European languages and Sanskrit, for example. I discovered some of those connections when I was writing my book on Russia. Before this book, I wrote another book called Occult Russia, And there are very, very interesting similarities between the Russian language and Sanskrit.
That's something I'll want to investigate now that I've checked out this book, because Germany and Russia are both areas of study for me personally that I've been underrepresented in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I've only had so much time that I've been interested in mythology and history. But I think this is a perfect time to go back all the way to Tacitus and what he said about the Germans and their religious systems, and how even what the Germans call their own nation derives from this more ancient father. Can you talk a bit about their sky god, sky god land?
Yeah, well, the original sort of primal grandfather of the German nation was Teut, or Teos. Teos, he's sometimes called, which is cognate with a Sanskrit word, dios, which refers to an Indian sky god, dios. The word teos really means sky god, or Teut, as one variation is. So Teos, or Teut, had a son called Manos, and Manos was the father of the Germans. He had three sons who became the progenitors of three German tribes, the Ingivones, Istiones, and Helmiones. So that's the mythical origin of the German people. And the town Mannheim is named after Manos. But I doubt very much if many people in Mannheim know that.
And that's what I wanted to get into. Although the details about that are scarce, it actually does suggest that connection between the Saxons and Buddha Sakya, because in Thailand, Buddha is still called Tat. And there are many gods of the ancient world that have this name that goes from a T to a T, or a TH to a TH. Yeah. Like Thoth is another perfect example. And in particular, that mythos of the great father and becoming three, or having three sons, is super common throughout world mythology. Yeah. Particularly the one called Manus is completely similar as like a founder and lawgiver to the Hindus Menu or Manu, or King Menes of ancient Egypt, another lawgiver, or Minos of Crete. There are more examples, but that's just what's off the top of my head.
The listeners might be interested in my website, which is www.ozgard, that's spelled ozgard.net, www.ozgard.net. You'll find information about my books and my lectures and other things. My book Occult Germany is officially published on April the 9th, and there's another book that's in the pipeline, which is a sort of autobiography, which I hope will appear sometime next year. So I've also enjoyed our conversation, and don't think I have anything more that I want to add right now.
All right. Well, it's been great to get to share in your experience and wisdom. And now that I've dipped my toes into your work, I am aware that there's a vast amount more that you've already done, and particularly interested in occult Russia. So thank you for your time. Thank you for staying up a little later to have this conversation across the time zones. And I wish you well, and enjoy your garden, sir.
Thank you very much.
And another great podcast in the archive. It's going into the archive. I loved this episode. Dr. McIntosh is a very experienced researcher with a grounded approach that his book is also really wide ranging. I enjoyed it a lot. There's many things I learned that I had not heard of before, Germany being a topic that I haven't delved into as much overall in my explorations. Maybe it's just, I'm a bit young. I can't touch it all yet. Anyway, I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to speak with him. I mean, this is a man who deserves respect simply for the fact of his eldership. You know, I think he's over 80 at this point, and many people younger than that, I personally know, who are not sharp on the ball and carrying and transmitting wisdom that well. So I appreciate that greatly, that we were able to capture some of that magic on Innerverse for at least one episode. The second hour is super juicy. I think we got him warmed up pretty well by that point. So if you want to have access to the full thing, you know the drill. Patreon or Rockfin are the ways to do it, or you can join my YouTube membership channel that is brand new. So there's three ways to get the full extended episode. And in part two, we continue discussing the mythical origin of the German people. I really like pulling on that thread of ancient Saxons as Buddhists, and there's so much reason to think that. I'll talk more about that after, you know, I go through the bullet points of the Plus extension. And there are many bullet points, though. We talked about the Irminsul, the sacred pillar or tree of the Saxons, evidence of the crucified savior motif before Christianity, Odin, the sacred center and the tree, their importance to the German psyche, the practice of, I'm going to butcher this word, Wasserschöpfen, the collecting of magic water on Easter. We talked about the memory and the mystical capacities of water and Germans who explored that in a scientific and spiritual way. We discussed the Odic force and Orgone energy, how this thread has been perpetually discovered, lost, and rediscovered by Germans, it seems. Storks were also discussed, the bringers of the Odic force. That was fascinating in context with the Pelagians that we just talked about with Dylan on Inner World Episode 2. The fascinating Rosicrucian concave mirrors as psychic enhancement technology. That's juicy. We also talked about Wagner, who I called Wagner, and the staged sacred festival drama of his plays. Really cool. Neo-paganism was the topic at the end, and we talked about avoiding the common pitfalls of religion for neo-pagans and Wiccans and witches. And we talked about the universal truths and the local unique truths. And that was fun. Overall, I thought that the second hour was better than the first, but I thought the first was awesome too. That said, if you liked the first even a little bit, $5 a month on Patreon is all you got to pay, and you get the whole archive of everything I've ever done. I think that you might be interested in that. I also wanted to talk about probably the biggest key, and even though it's so simple, it was just like, click, how did I miss that, is the name that the Germans call their own nation, Deutschland. It starts with the letters D-E-U-T, which is just a D to T swap from Teut. They were called the Teutonic people at one point. And then we talked about this with Dr. McIntosh, of course, but that's Thoth. That's Buddha, who is also Tot. So much to that. I also considered how philologically the Jur of German could be a connection to Kel, as the G and K sounds are interchangeable and the R and L sounds are interchangeable. Thus, German and Celtic, which are, of course, culturally well identified as related or similar or the same. There's other things, though, in his book that we just couldn't get to. Particularly would have loved to discuss the German philosophers of the 18th and or the 19th and 20th centuries, like Nietzsche and a little more about Jung. I do think we got some good Jung in there. I'm pretty sure this audience is familiar enough with it, but German idealism as a subject is fascinating. And there's so many incredible thinkers and suppressed philosophers from that, that it's a bit ridiculous. But overall, I think that we could have talked a lot longer. I think the pacing was fine, although Dr. McIntosh was a little concerned about the speed of responses or pauses. And I told him, you know what? This audience doesn't care. This audience respects the silence. We're in it for the vibe, and there's a good vibe going on between me and him. So there's nothing to worry about. I'm not going to edit out. I used to be such a perfectionist editing out the pauses and the ums and the gaps, and there's just no need for it. Another thing that reading his book made me think about, though, was how Odin's two ravens are called Hugin and Munin, meaning thought and memory. And that is so similar to Prometheus and Epimetheus, who are forethought and afterthought. Also, Hugin, I've recently learned the name Hugo, for example, it means like intellect or mind. So there's a connection to our Upsilon Eta Sigma or Hughes, which is an epithet of Bacchus, Hugin. And then with that rhoticism of N's and R's interchanging, the Munin could be a mirror or mirror, which is a water idea and phonetically. Thus, Munin meaning memory makes a little more sense. I mean, there's a perfect example of whether or not that switch between N and R happened in at some point, and that's how Munin became Munin and wasn't Muir or Mir or Mare. The fact is, memory and water are connected ideas, and those words mean that. And Munin is carrying that philological link. Super interesting. Also really like the section about Hildegard, and you know, she's this, I think she was like a nun. And there's this part about these modern doctors who applied one of her recipes for treating, I don't even want to say the word because of YouTube, but the big C, cancer. And that this method consisted of a complicated honey wine vinegar extract out of eel gall, ginger, long pepper, ivory powder, and the powder from a vulture beak. A preparation that involved great difficulties. And then they said these doctors, Strelau and Hertzka, write positively about the use of this remedy in homeopathic doses. That's super interesting. I also didn't realize how many alchemical authors that are famous, like Cornelius Agrippa, were actually Germans. Like his first name is Heinrich, or that, was it Paracelsus, the Germanness of that guy. He has these alchemists just take on a mystical name and leave behind their original, but there's so many roots to this stuff in Germany. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you guys did too. Hope you're doing well out there. There's tons of ways to support Interverse if you're interested. But I also recommend supporting Dr. McIntosh and picking up one of his books. He's got a lot of subjects that you might enjoy exploring. Somebody read Occult Russia and let me know what the golden thread of gravy within that. I'd appreciate it. And check the show notes for links to all of his stuff, for links to the ways you can support Interverse. There's the merch store. There's Tippecanoe Herbs, my favorite way you can support me other than getting a tuning. Use the Interverse code at checkout for 10% off. We've also got a new affiliation with Oregonite and the coupon code Interverse for that. That's Oregon-ite, OREGON-ITE.com. Great stuff. I've enjoyed the pieces that Isaac from Oregonite has shared with me. And I recommend you guys check it out too, especially if you don't have any Oregonite yet. And it's kind of a perfect episode about that because we talked about the Odic force and orgone energy in this conversation. Didn't even plan it to be all connected like that. And of course, there's the Spirit World series narrated by me And there's a brand new Spirit World book available as an audiobook now. Book 6, Terminalia. Good stuff there. And last but not least, the new show, Inner World, with me and Dylan Sikosho. We're now 2 episodes deep on that. I'm not going to make any promises or commitment to a weekly show with that. I will say it's going to at least monthly, but maybe multiple a month, depends on the month, depends on what we've got to share. But I wouldn't be mad if we managed to pull it off weekly. We'll see. There's definitely stuff in there, deep research that like is so profound it deserves support, meaning $5 a month on Patreon, $8 a month on the YouTube membership, that or join Dylan's Substack to get access to it. But currently they're coming out sooner on my side. So, you know, you love me. Do it on my side. Do both of ours. Actually, you should. $5 a month to Dylan's Substack is worth it to support that guy. He's a great guy. And with that, we're going to wrap it up, but I hope you're having a great St. Paddy's Day. I know it's like quite far from then at the point you're hearing this, but that's what day it is today for me in my present moment. So I'm going to go have some fun with my family and get out of here, but it's been a blast. Love my job. Love that you're here along for the ride, and you guys be good. I'll catch you on the next one. I'm gonna go get some more.